All right. Good afternoon. On behalf of the entire energy and environment team here at Pillsbury Law Firm, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. My name is Jeff Merrifield, and I head up Pillsbury's energy section. Early in my career, I spent 10 years working in the Senate and was a counsel on the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. I also served as a two-term commissioner of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission under Presidents Bush and Clinton, and 7 years as a senior executive with a large engineering and construction firm specializing in the power industry. In addition to leading our energy practice, I'm also closely associated with Pillsbury's public policy group. It is my pleasure to be the moderator for today's discussion. Today, we've brought together several of Pillsbury's energy and environmental experts to discuss the impacts of President Trump's March 28th Energy Independence Executive Order Number 13783, and how that fits into the broader energy deregulatory agenda of the Trump administration. Order 13783 was broadly seen as the first step of the Trump administration's repeal of the Clean Power Plan. But the core of the order represents a much more expansive regulatory reform agenda to promote domestic energy production. After having studied the order, we felt it was important for our clients to better understand the order and also the opportunities and challenges it presented to the energy industry. Before I go any further, I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce my colleagues who will join me in the discussion of the executive order here today. First, to my immediate left is Sheila Harvey, who is a senior partner and head of the firm's climate practice and energy industry team, which incorporates all the disciplines of the firm which work in the energy industry. While Sheila's practice spans several regulatory specialties, the bulk of her work is focused on the environmental issues associated with energy, mining, and general manufacturing sectors. Sheila is part of the firm's core group, which is tracking the broad range of regulatory reform initiatives of the Trump administration. Immediately to Sheila's left is Matt Morrison, who is a partner in Pillsbury's Energy Environmental Group. Matt joined Pillsbury in 2013 after 23 years of enforcement experience at the EPA and the Department of Justice, where he handled numerous civil and criminal enforcement cases, including actions directly affecting the energy sector. Matt has seen several changes in administration over his career, and his practice today focuses on defensive enforcement litigation and regulatory compliance counseling for the energy and chemical sectors. Finally, to my right is Andy Weissman, who is currently serving as senior counsel in the firm's energy practice. Andy has deep energy experience, has deep expertise in energy and environmental regulation at the federal and state level, and is considered one of the nation's leading experts on natural gas and oil matters. Earlier in his career, Andy also pioneered emissions trading at the federal level in the U.S., structuring nearly all of the transactions under Title IV of the Clean Air Act relating to acid rain after the first few years after it was enacted. For today's session, I'll be posing a series of questions for our panel, and time permitting, we will open up for questions from our audience. Now, I will make one technical note. As this is a webinar and you are seeing this on your screen, there is a box in the lower right-hand side where you can click on if you want to see us in more of a full-screen mode. So with that, I want to begin with Andy. The executive order specifically compels all federal executive departments and agencies to review any regulations, rules, or policies which, quote, burden, unquote, the safe, efficient development of domestic energy resources, with particular attention to oil, natural gas, coal, and nuclear energy resources, and to begin proceedings to suspend, revise, or rescind them. The order defines burden broadly to mean unnecessarily obstruct, delay, curtail, or otherwise impose significant costs on the siting, permitting, production, utilization, transmission, or delivery of energy resources. From the face of it, the executive order seems to be a very broad-sweeping scope of authority and certainly appears it could have significant impacts on a wide range of industries and individuals, many of them our clients. To help frame the discussion today, what do you see are really the main takeaways of the executive order and perhaps some of the timing associated with their implementation?
Sure. Thanks, Jeff. I thought emphasize kind of four aspects of the Trump administration's actions and what we're going to cover today. One, I just want to underscore the point you've already made regarding the extraordinary breadth of the action of this executive order. And breadth is really in two respects. One, it does apply to every executive department and executive agency. And I just want to give some examples, because I think the tendency when the executive order was issued was to assume that this was mainly about environmental regulation and mainly about EPA. And it certainly has huge implications for environmental regulation and EPA, but it does go much broader. And just to tick off a few examples, really solely for giving to give the our listeners a sense of the breadth of this, it certainly has huge implications for actions that potentially can be taken by the Department of Energy, for example. And we think our firm has done a lot of work with respect to LNG exports. There's been a big public controversy for several years now regarding the standards that DOE ought to apply in determining whether to allow exports of liquefied natural gas, particularly to the majority of countries that are not signatories to a free trade agreement with the United States. That policy is potentially subject to complete revision under this rulemaking and potentially streamlining it greatly because of the flexibility provided under that particular statute. In addition, for example, DOE during the Obama administration has established almost 100 different energy efficiency standards that apply to appliances and equipment. They're all potentially subject to review. IRS regulations that affect the energy industry are potentially subject to review. And in addition, as we'll talk about more later, there are a myriad of independent agencies that may not be directly subject to the order, but nonetheless might apply it in ways that are very significant. So there's a great deal of breadth in that way, but also want to emphasize just as much, it applies not just to agency rules, but to policies and guidelines and the White House statement that accompanied the rollout of this executive order actually emphasized that it is intended to be a starting point for revisiting policies essentially by every federal agency that's involved in energy, and that the intent of the executive order is to look both backwards at existing rules and forward on new policies.
So let me just frame this a little bit more.
Sure.
When we talk broadly on energy, we're really talking sort of, and I'm going to put this into really two buckets. You have the traditional oil and gas industry, and here you're talking upstream, midstream, downstream, the full panoply of areas, pipelines, offshore, onshore. So this rulemaking really, or this executive order really reaches into the full breadth of activities there for review to determine if it is burdensome. And then similarly, the other bucket being the electricity industry. So from the standpoint of, I think about nuclear, all the way from uranium mining through enrichment, fuel fabrication, the generation at the plants, same thing for any number of these forms of generation out there, reaching all the way from the source of power. And you sort of wonder, and this may actually reach all the way down into consumer level to a certain degree, because although that is regulated by the states typically at a PUC level, to the extent that FERC is involved in some of that, it could have a much broader approach than some may fully appreciate.
Definitely. Just on the last point, it actually explicitly applies to both energy development and energy use. So that's the first major point, the breadth. The second is the need to act quickly. And in terms of the timing associated with this program, it's intended to be both very broad and potentially potentially sweeping in its effects and occur very quickly. And so there's three steps. And the first is that the order was issued March 28th, and that started a 45-day clock that requires every affected agency, every single one, to submit to the White House and OMB a plan as to how it will implement the order, and particularly how it will identify the rules and policies that meet the statutory the standard established by the executive order. And then the second step is just 120 days after the order was issued, which is basically August 1st, every agency is going to have to identify, submit a draft plan to the White House and DOE that identifies every relevant action that it intends to review further and what it intends to do. In some instances, it may be able to rescind existing rules, for example, immediately. In other instances, to comply with the Administrative Procedure Act, there may be a more complicated procedure, but within by August 1st, going to approach us very quickly, the agency has to submit, every agency has to submit a draft plan to the White House and OMB, and then by 180 days, roughly October 1st, the agencies have to start implementing their plans. So that's the fact that this is going to occur very quickly, and therefore that it's critical to dive into it now, if you haven't already, and to be prepared to interact with the agencies and departments quickly is a second important takeaway.
Yeah, and that one, I'm going to put that one in the parking lot for
sure,
a moment.
Sure.
I think there are some specific things that we need to sort of chat about what that means for our clients and how that may go forward. But I just want to sort of put that in the parking lot.
Sure.
I'll let you finish.
Sure. Well, I'll be real quick because there are two more. But the first is that the executive order establishes essentially a new legal standard. It basically says, agency, you have a statute in many instances. You have to comply with the statute. It doesn't relieve you of that. But whereas in the past the agencies may have just really used as a starting point that you have a statute or other rule that by its nature does create burdens on energy use and development, and whereas that previously has been the framework for evaluating actions, there's a new framework, and the new framework says essentially you still have to look at the statute if you're acting under a statute, but then you also have to systematically identify every way that this potentially impedes energy development or adds significant cost, and then you have to apply a public interest standard and do a weighing and balancing of whatever you've looked at previously and the potential adverse effects on energy and development and use. And then the last aspect, which I could say in a sentence basically, is that this whole program creates both lots of opportunities and lots of risks. So you know, the natural tendency, there's a lot of interest on the part of various industries to look at ways to relax regulation, and you know that's certainly kind of the core thrust of this, and on the other hand, depending on where you sit, that may or may not be a positive thing. So you have to follow this closely. I mentioned already energy efficiency. If you're manufacturing appliances or equipment, you may or may not want the standards relaxed.
Yeah. So I think that's a really good point to make, and that is, I think a lot of folks initially looking at this were under the impression, this is great. We certain things for the energy industry that regulations can be rolled back, but life is a little bit more zero-sum game than sometimes people appreciate. And to the extent that one person is getting a benefit, somebody else's ox may be getting gored. Well, Sheila, in that context, and as Andy has described it, the order seems very sweeping in scope. But obviously, we can't talk about this in a vacuum. The executive order is just one piece of what the Trump administration is trying to accomplish. Can you give us sort of a context of where this fits overall in the efforts to reform some of the other energy and environmental issues there?
Well, I think I would thank you for that question, Jeff. I would start by noting that there have been, since January, since the Trump administration occupied the White House, there have been more than 30 executive orders issued. You know, all presidents do them. This is not an extraordinary pace of issuing executive orders, but it's a pretty good pace of issuing them. There's clearly a theme, whether it's pertinent to the energy industry or not, that there is a theme running throughout most of the executive orders, which is to reduce regulatory burden. There are specific executive orders for the energy industry. The energy industry clearly occupies a special focus within the White House and the current administration because, you know, President Trump, even starting during his campaign speeches, you know, was really focused on allowing America to really become a dominant global supplier of energy and wants to do everything that the administration can do to facilitate the development of the energy resources of the U.S. Ostensibly, without really impeding the core environmental functions of the early agency, but clearly retrenching from some of the more recent expansions of environmental programs. So pertinent to the energy industry in particular, you have several executive orders. The second one that the Trump administration issued was an executive order directing an expedited environmental review for critical infrastructure projects. You know, the main focus of this seem to be some of the DOT-related issues, surface transportation, bridges, tunnels, but it does include energy. And there are existing lists of critical infrastructures, but again, the list can be expanded. And so he's very focused on retrenching the NEPA process to its original purpose, and it's particularly important for critical infrastructure. So this is where he marries his interest in energy industry and infrastructure.
Let me just sort of follow up on that one, because as it relates to that particular piece, that appeal would go to whoever is the person designated as the head of the Council on Environmental Quality, and that expedited review process would clearly involve significant activities with that individual. Seems that appointment, as a result, is even more critical in this administration than perhaps some may have considered.
Yes, to fulfill the purpose of the order. Yes, I think that I agree with you.
Now that hasn't. There's some names that have surfaced around, some of which are friends of the firm. But certainly, I guess we'll all have to sit very carefully watch, you know, who that person's going to be and see where they go. Okay.
So the second executive order issued pertinent to the energy industry was one. It included the energy industry, but it was broader. It was an executive order designed to reduce regulatory burdens and the costs imposed by unnecessary regulation. The guidance issued subsequent to that order suggests that the purpose was to really focus on rules that had more than $100 million impact to the national economy. So they're not going to look at every little tiny rule, but they are definitely going to have a broad review and potential reform of federal regulations. This is the executive order frequently referred to as the two-for-one.
Two-for-one.
So for every new rule that's issued, two have to be withdrawn.
So there seems to be a nexus here. We've got that executive order. For every rule you issue, you've got to repeal two.
Yes.
That plays obviously quite well with the burden reduction requirements within the executive order, which is really the heart of the discussion today.
Yes.
There is an nexus there. Less is more in the Trump administration, I guess, is clearly the message.
Again, another broad order issued was simply the broad executive order directed at reforming the executive branch, reforming all of the agencies. That will obviously be a significant effort for the energy businesses and will affect energy regulation and environmental regulation. But again, although it's not specifically targeted to this industry, it is broad and will, you know, I think be an important factor in how everything plays out, even under the order we're really focused on today. There are a couple others that I'll mention briefly. There was the executive order to restore the rule of law and federalism and economic growth focused on the waters of the United States. So, again, it is consistent with the theme of bringing back to the original purpose and intent of some of the environmental programs as they were maybe understood in the 70s. And to narrow the expansive definition of waters of the United States that has been adopted through various judicial opinions in the last several years. There's the order we're talking about today, 13783. More on that as the hour goes on. And finally, one of the more recent executive orders was simply an order to promote the development of offshore energy resources.
Yes. And you can see a series of efforts being undertaken by the administration to,
yes,
to sort of clear the decks and open up some areas,
yes,
for exploration,
yes,
that had previously been thought were really sort of off the
table. And I think, you know, we're focused today on a particular executive order and generally on executive orders, but there are a lot of things going on in the federal agencies right now, including at the Department of Energy, looking at national security issues and power supply and the security of the grid. And although not an executive order, it clearly is a very high priority for the Department of Energy, coming out within 60 days, a report coming out in 60 days, really focus on the state of big baseload power in the United,
yeah,
States and what the administration can do to protect big baseload power in the U.S.
Yeah, we're you know, as a firm, as a section, we're tracking that one very, very closely because of the significant impact it's going to have on baseload, intermediate load, and then some of the renewables that have been put on the grid more recently. We're talking a little bit about DOE, and Sheila was talking about some of the impacts there. Matt, having been an alumnus of EPA, when you look at the executive order, clearly it went straight after the Clean Power Plan. Easier said than done in some regards. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, all right, if the administrator of the EPA wants to move ahead and remove the Clean Power Plan, what needs to be done in that regard?
Sure.
Further notice and rulemaking. How is this all going to play out? Maybe you can sketch for
sure
how that's going to happen.
Well, it'll take some time, and it'll be a pretty big lift, Jeff. The agency won't be able to simply rescind the rule. It will have to go through notice and comment. Notice and comment will require the agency to come up with independent information, new information, or new analysis on existing information to justify it. Then it would go into a proposed final finding, which inevitably will be subject to litigation. So start to finish, I would say on the short side, we'd be talking a couple of years before anything really gets pulled back. And I think it'll be quite a lift. The lift would get even bigger if the administration decides to take it a step further beyond the Clean Power Plan and take on the endangerment finding. So there are some environmental groups that look at this whole issue and say, you really need to get at the root issue. It's that endangerment finding we need to revisit. That's, again, a very heavy lift, and the agency would have to swim against the tide of all the scientific findings it made when it did that finding.
Right.
No small lift. Back on the litigation side of things, this is all before the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit is now, as of April 28th, given the agency about 60 days to Fisher Cut date on whether it wants this remanded or whether it would be held in abeyance. My sense is that my prediction is that the agency will seek a voluntary remand. That would do two things. It would terminate the litigation, and secondly, it would send the entire rule back to the agency for further deliberation, essentially accomplishing what it wants. So I don't think one option people have discussed is, would the agency simply stall? Could an administrator Pruitt just sit on this? I don't think the D.C. Circuit will allow it. I even think environmental groups would file an action for that the agency make a decision. So I don't think stalling is in the cards. So I see within the next 60 days the agency probably taking the choice of that voluntary remand, and that'll probably how it proceeds.
Let's just, and I don't want to skip this one because not all of the folks who are watching this webinar sort of come from the same base of knowledge. Can you talk just a little bit more about the endangerment finding and put that into context?
Sure. Well, so the endangerment finding goes back, I believe it was 2009. Right,
yep.
2009. Administrator at the time, Lisa Jackson, made the. There's a trickle-down effect. Without going through too much history,
A Supreme Court case required the agency make a finding one way or the other. Either you're in or you're out of regulating greenhouse gases through Title II of the Clean Air Act. Title II, of course, being the provision that governs vehicles, fuels, and engines. So the agency made that finding and saying, yes, there is an endangerment that requires the agency to regulate greenhouse gases. And once that finding was made, EPA, upon the issuance of that rule under Title II, was fully in the game of regulating greenhouse gases. They became essentially a regulated pollutant, and that unleashed a bunch of implications throughout the Clean Air Act, New Source Review, and other programs where it became a regulated pollutant. So you'd have to rewind the clock way back to 2009
Wow.
to pull that back in. And again,
a lot of folks who may not be familiar with the details of how that came to pass, who want to say, well, President Trump, you need to just repeal it.
Just pull it back.
But that is you know, functionally, given the involvement of the Supreme Court and a lot of other folks, that's a heavy.
Yeah, it's a difficult decision because, you know, they could try and they could fail.
Yeah.
And if they fail, arguably it might even aggravate the situation from their point of view.
They could be really foisted by
yeah.
their own petard.
Yeah.
They have a substantial scientific record to support
right.
that endangerment finding. It wasn't just a memo from Lisa Jackson. There's voluminous support for it. So they would have to really go against all that or prove that all of that base of knowledge was incorrectly analyzed or improper. And that's a big lift.
Well, let me switch back to you, Sheila, for a moment. One of the things that the executive order does is it has some specific guidance relative to the Council on Environmental Quality guidelines on greenhouse gases, and also an initiative that was undertaken by the Obama administration relative to the sort of crafting what would be the social cost of carbon. What's going on with those in the context of the executive order?
So the order actually specifically withdraws three rules or guidances, and among them is the CEQ guidance on how to evaluate the cost of greenhouse gases during the NEPA review process. So that guidance, because the executive order applies to rules, guidances, and policies, not just rules.
Yep.
It also stated that it is no longer the policy of the federal government to use the work product of the interagency work group that the Obama administration had on the social cost of carbon. So the data that they had developed and the numbers that they had developed have been withdrawn and will not be used as a basis for any federal decision making. The third policy withdrawn by the order, it was a direction to the Secretary of the Department of Interior to withdraw the moratorium on coal leasing on federal lands. And so all three of those were immediately gone. The order obviously begins a study of many things, most prominently the Clean Power Plan that Matt just described. Now, having said all of that, the order essentially rescinds the CEQ guidance that you started with, and
yep.
the social cost of carbon.
Yep.
That does not mean that every federal agency no longer has to think about the impact of greenhouse gases during the NEPA review process. Every agency now will have to, you know, evaluate how to value that, because the agencies are still charged under NEPA to evaluate the costs and benefits of any federal action. So that they will have to develop some methodology for valuing the impact on climate of various projects, but they will not be using the specific rules that have been withdrawn. And obviously, given everything that's going on with the executive orders and with various federal agency rules, they are going to, you know, really focus narrowly on the original intent of the basic statutes that are involved in the review process.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you know, we talked about some of the duties that the new head of CEQ is going to have coming on board.
Yes, that'll be one of them.
A little bit of clipping
yes.
wings there, too, in terms of repeal of that guidance, which will be interesting to see. I would make a comment. You know, we have a number of clients who are involved both in exploration, development, and use of coal assets.
certainly the repeal of that executive order, which would allow development on federal lands, provides an opportunity if those companies want to move forward. There is remaining a healthy export market for U.S. coal, so that may be of great benefit. I would say, at least in the clients that I talk to among our utility clients, a lot of folks have sort of put their bets down on, because of the Clean Power Plan and other things, of retiring coal assets. You know, we talked about a little bit internally, really don't see a lot of those getting turned around. There may be some delays of shutting down some plants, but not going to have a real major impact on continuing a lot of coal that was otherwise planned to be going down.
Coal remains challenged by a number of factors, some including state regulation, and these orders have nothing to do with state regulation, but also they're just market issues that are
price
posing...
Price of natural gas, right?
...posing challenges to coal, yes.
Indeed. Well, Andy, I think we want to get into a little bit more of the meat of the executive order. Maybe you can describe the scope and purpose of the order's required review of administrative actions that affect energy development and use, what companies might be potentially affected, and what are the steps that they really ought to be taking right now to protect their interests?
Sure. Let me emphasize maybe a couple points in response to that, Jeff. The first is the intent of the executive order, its core purpose, is fairly radical, and specifically the intention is to, whereas the Obama administration was very clear that the single most important driving force in a lot of the regulation of energy development use was going to be climate change and efforts to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, in terms of the federal role, and that's a lot of states are still very active in that area, but in terms of the federal role, the intent of the executive order is that the federal government will back off that almost entirely. And at the same time, what the executive order is intended to do is impose a new policy priority for all of federal regulation of energy development and use. And that priority really is to maximize energy development and energy use. We may all recall during the campaign, then-candidate Trump basically suggesting that one of the best ways to grow the U.S. economy was essentially to maximize development of all our domestic energy resources. And this executive order is really intended to put real teeth into that campaign promise and really requires stepping back and thinking, what does that really mean if that's going to be the number one goal?
Yeah.
And then in terms of actions, and this is really, in some respects, the most important purpose of our scheduling this webcast, as we mentioned before, this is occurring very quickly. And so I think it's important for all of our listeners to really think about this in two ways. One, it's imperative to really try to identify, to get plugged into this process and understand, as we mentioned, the initial plan as to how each agency will identify the potentially relevant policies and rules is due essentially immediately next week. And so it's important, the first recommendation really would be it's important to figure out, to inform yourself of what the agencies already are planning to look at. And then the second recommendation is to be proactive and to think creatively, and that essentially whoever you are, wherever you're situated, what would you ideally like to see the federal government do to roll back obstacles and also to foster development. That obviously we talked about both opportunities and risks and not everything being a zero-sum game, and suggest, one example is certainly the question of what this will mean for renewables. And the essentially, to some degree, I think the executive order sets up something of a competition between natural gas and renewables, and potentially to some degree between nuclears and renewables. And we actively represent a number of companies in both areas, but essentially every natural gas producer, or as you pointed out earlier, anyone in the chain, upstream, midstream, and downstream, needs to think through thoroughly how do they make their strongest case to the agencies, and the renewable industry just as much so.
Yeah, so just to put some clarity on it for our listeners, this is incredibly important. This is a very wide door that has opened up.
Yes.
Right? And so if you have a business, if you're part of an industry that touches on energy in its myriad of forms, oil and gas, electricity generation, and whatnot.
And as you pointed out earlier, energy use.
And energy
use. The whole economy.
If you're almost the whole economy. If, there are issues out there that you think are burdening you, there's obviously an opportunity to appeal to appropriate departments and agencies and ask them, put your hand up. This is a particular rule or policy that we think burdens us. We want it for your consideration. So that's one opportunity. On the other side, there's a whole defensive posture that some folks are going to have to take because, again, getting back to the zero-sum game, there may be some policies or rules suggested for modification or revision that could adversely impact you. So the things other folks suggest may be an issue.
If I can just sorry, I don't mean
to. No, and I was going to say, but to go to your timing, I think the next you talked about the first deadline coming up very quickly, but the August 1st deadline where the agency or department has to put together its initial list, that's going to be, to me, sounds like a very critical date for folks to evaluate what's coming out from those departments and agencies, and does it either negatively affect my business, or are there areas that they should have made suggestions to that haven't been implemented, that perhaps follow-up needs to be made about the final list?
Definitely, and I think, just to expand a little bit on renewables as an example, we have the development of the renewables in the United States has been very heavily dependent upon not only the tax benefits that have been enacted by Congress, but exactly how those have been interpreted and applied. And there are also a whole bunch of DOE programs, loan guarantees and the like that are relevant. Those are all going to be revisited. And so it is definitely will be important between now and August 1st for the renewable industry, just to cite one example, to really marshal its case in terms of the fundamental goal of the executive order is economic growth. And both natural gas and renewables really do contribute in major ways to economic growth for the renewable industry. And anyone tied to it in any way, it will be very important to try to make out the strongest case possible as to whether there should be changes, and if so, exactly what?
Wow, it just strikes me here, sitting here, that the tentacles of this I can't think of a company out there that might not in some way be touched or impacted.
Yes,
potentially by this one executive order. Enormous reach,
and very fast. So it's important to mobilize internally.
Wow. Okay. Well, let me. I want to turn back a second back to Matt. One of the agencies, obviously DOE is a department that's going to have a lot to do with this, but EPA is one that's going to be adversely impacted. What are the folks over there thinking these days? How are they going to respond to this level of deregulated effort that's clearly directed square at them?
Well, contrary to popular belief about the EPA enforcement shop, it's not a group of people who engage in subversion and retribution, and they're probably watching this very carefully. They will enforce whatever statute is enacted and whatever regs are promulgated.
I'm thinking even beyond enforcement.
Yeah.
I mean, this
oh, sure.
Really, the heart
sure.
of this executive order really
sure.
goes down
okay.
to – the folks who are involved in the rulemaking, virtually every policy
sure.
of the department in some way may be affected.
So I'll take that in two little pieces. The enforcement piece, again, there are people who are going to be watching it very carefully. And, you know, within, as you all know, the famous phrase, enforcement discretion allows the enforcement shop to fill a lot of gaps. Even if you have an executive order that tweaks, modifies some of the current regulatory framework, they will have that enforcement license, if you will, to ensure, in their minds, protection of human health and the environment.
Yeah.
But first and foremost, they're going to say, we enforce the laws as written.
I think, and pertinent to the Waters of the United States executive order, I think EPA has announced that they are dropping a few of the enforcement cases based on the very expansive understanding of Waters of the United States. That might be one concrete, immediate.
Sure, and there, admittedly, I've seen quite a few cases, particularly wetlands cases, where you look at the facts and, you know, it is one of those things where bad facts make bad law, and where the agency stretches a little too far, it sometimes gets a little bit of a judicial pushback. But it's also important to understand the enforcement shop role in the agency rulemaking process as we go forward and look at tweaks or revisions.
Yeah.
Most significant rules pass through the enforcement shop, and it has the opportunity to comment on these rules. Typically, and this will come as a shock to many, the enforcement shop's comment is frequently the same as industry, which is, first and foremost, make it clear and make it understandable and really clear enough to be enforceable. So clarity and certainty are the friends of industry and also the friends of enforcement. Where the agency, where the enforcement shop can get out of its lane is if it starts to address issues of stringency. And that's typically supposed to be the purview of the program office, the Office of Air or Office of Water. Those are two fundamental things in the review of these rules. The enforcement shop will frequently look at anything that seems to hamstring its authority or make a mandate voluntary or pull back on its ability to enforce. It'll obviously comment aggressively there.
I would say in that score, too, I think, you know, going back to 13783, the executive order, it was, when you read through it, it was carefully crafted in order to say, you know, nothing here isn't going to be a violation of existing environmental laws.
Right.
I mean, so I think there was a sort of a careful nod to the role that the agency is going to have in making sure that existing laws relative to the environment aren't superseded by the executive order.
That's right. So they all have to fit within the statutory framework. That's right. There's only so much administrative license they'll be able to take. And lastly, keep in mind that, you know, states, there's a trickle-down effect. So if a lot of these are delegated programs or authorized programs. So if EPA decides to make adjustments to its administrative authorities, that may not immediately be changed in the states. And the states may be following that old framework, and they're the frontline enforcers on many regulated programs. But I want to flip this back to you a little bit, Jeff, because you – we talked a lot about EPA and all the agencies directly covered by this order. You have experience outside of those agencies and with some that are indirectly affected. I'm wondering if you could tell us about some of those.
As I mentioned before, you know, I was a commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and as an independent agency, they are treated differently within the context of this executive order. And there are a series of executive agencies that sort of fall in the same category: FERC, Mining Health and Safety Administration, Surface Transportation Administration, things of that nature. Each of them is a little different as well. And I'll use FERC and the NRC as an example. Both of them are independent agencies. Not all independent agencies are equally independent. And I would say FERC is probably more closely tied in with what's going on at the department overall. You've got a couple of new members that who are being appointed right now. I think FERC will probably, independent as they are, they will probably try to hew a little bit closer to the spirit of this document. The NRC, for its part, has announced that you know the executive order requires the appointment of an individual who would be the lead for that. NRC said, no, we're not doing that. We're an independent agency. Now, having said that, there are two openings for New Republicans. There's been some talk of people being appointed there.
I suspect, you know, any of the political appointees that are going through the White House nomination process right now are being,
right,
you know, gee, I hope you understand the president has an executive order and he expects his nominees to,
yeah,
to be mindful of that. And I expect that as it normally does, in the case of the NRC, they will try to do what they can within the spirit of it, even though they will not be held accountable to it. So I think it's a little bit of a mix. As I said before, independent agencies aren't required to follow it, but I think what you'll see is, depending upon the agency, a lot of them try to meet the spirit of the executive order. One of the other things that's in the order, Andy, is the Regulatory Reform Task Force. And can you talk a little bit about the role that it plays in the reform effort and how that interacts with both the White House and OMB?
Sure. And if I can, maybe I'd also like to comment a little bit on what might happen before FERC.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, please do.
Okay. In terms of the Regulatory Reform Task Force, it's, as many of you are aware, one of the first actions in the Trump administration was to require a regulatory reform task force within most of the major departments and agencies. And those are likely to play a particularly important role here. I think, for example, of someone like Daniel Simmons, who has the task force at DOE, Department of Energy, comes out of the Institute for Energy Research, has done a lot of policy work. Those offices really may, to a large degree, have the lead internally in implementing these requirements. And the structure is that they're all really reporting to Vice President Pence as the head of this effort and to the White House and OMB. So what we've seen in other areas with the Trump administration, we'll just have to see how this is implemented, is that an awful lot in the early days has been directed from the top, and we'll see whether that happens here. With respect to FERC, my own view is that one of the most important issues this executive order raises is the extent to which the White House, OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, and the Department of Energy in particular, will take a much more active role in trying to create policies to guide FERC. FERC is an independent agency, and so the decision-making authority, as you said, will ultimately rest with the commissioners, and they have a lot of autonomy in that respect. But when you step back and look at energy use in the United States, pricing of energy, and what ultimately drives the power industry, the coal industry, the natural gas industry, and renewables, FERC plays an absolutely critical role. 70% of the power sales in the United States are now basically subject to rules by FERC and the regional transmission organizations. And FERC also has even more comprehensive authority over siting of natural gas, approvals of natural gas pipelines. I'd say a lot of the issues, given the so far, FERC, FERC doesn't have any responsibility for formulating policy per se, but its actions have tremendous policy implications. And what we've already seen in the early days of the Trump administration is, and it's kind of ironic because we have a Secretary of Energy who not long ago was urging abolishing the Department of Energy, but what's actually happening is exactly the opposite. When the DOE was first created, it actually had responsibility for developing a national energy policy. What's already happening is that DOE is starting to study a number of critical issues that ultimately are major issues of national policy but require actions by FERC, such as, for example, potentially supporting and changing the FERC rules with respect to regulation of baseload power plants and the approach with renewables.
Well, and I think one, and a lot of folks may have missed this one, but you know, there was authority within the FAST Act several years ago for the Secretary of Energy to be given authority to step in and act relative to specific generation assets if it was in a national importance. And there was a coal facility down in Texas, the name of which I can't remember, where, correct me if I'm wrong, the Secretary did take those very same actions because of a concern about grid stability to say, no, that coal plant, which was going to shut down, is going to need to stay online.
Yeah, and I think so far DOE seems to be focusing on what its statutory authority. But I think as this evolves, at least in terms of opportunities for industry, really the question may become, you know, in every area, you know, what's the policy towards renewables? What's the policy? What are the pricing rules that DOE may wind up taking kind of a leadership role? When the department was first established, if there was actually an entire arm of the department that was set up to intervene both before the FARC and actually in state regulatory proceedings. And kind of ironically, as the Department of Energy focuses more on how to achieve the president's policy goals, I think it may actually wind up, and certainly it potentially could affect and even benefit a number of industries, it may actually wind up taking a much more active role outside of areas where it has direct authority, but in establishing federal policies and actually intervening before FERC or the Commodity Futures Trading Commission or the Surface Transportation Board or any of a number of other agencies, yeah, in a way that may have that certainly I would think direct this to you as a former NRC commissioner, is that that every administrative agency would take pretty seriously,
yeah,
what the administration policy is.
No, I think that's right. Of course, counterbalanced against that is, you know, at this point, Secretary Perry doesn't have a lot of folks over there at DOE to help out on all that. So that remains to be seen. Now, you mentioned someone I think we do need to mention, you know, the role of OMB in this whole process. When you look at the pictures of the executive order being signed, Mick Mulvaney, former congressman, former advocate for the Freedom Caucus up in the House, new head of OMB, expect OMB to be very, very involved in the development of these rules going forward. Second thing is, we mentioned it before, we got Neil Chatterjee, senior policy advisor to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Robert Powelson, who is a former PUC member, or is a PUC member in Pennsylvania, and the head of NARUC, the two new Republican nominations. I expect some of these questions we've had about the president's executive order and its impact are going to see themselves appear when their hearings, when their nomination hearings come up.
And I know you've worked with many of these people closely in the past,
I have.
The White House is going to play a key role. I know you've spent more than a little bit of time there in recent weeks.
That's right.
Expect that the DOE report on the national security issues for the grid will be out by the time those hearings happen. So I suspect I'll get questions on that as well.
A couple of lightning questions I want to do because we are getting toward the end. Matt, on executive order, renewable fuel standards, any impacts you see there?
Yeah, huge. I mean, the renewable fuel standard program has been subject to a lot of criticism and comment since it started in 2005, the Energy Policy Act amended in 2007, the Energy Independence and Security Act. And so for 10 years, we've been hearing shouts from the ag interest, the oil interest, and other interests all throwing bricks at one aspect or another. So I certainly presume that we're going to see heavy comment through the executive order process on renewable fuels. I think it's interesting to note that I think it was just last week, Administrator Pruitt surprised some people by saying that he would support higher blends of ethanol if they could remove the regulatory barriers within the statutory framework. And that was a little bit of a marker along the lines of the CEO saying, if we can do it, we will blend more. We will meet our mandates in the renewable fuel standards.
Interesting. A lot of farmers in the Midwest.
A lot of
music
farm
to their ears.
Yeah, it is music.
And there are refineries that have a huge stake in the
affected. Absolutely. Hey, one I want to mention. Any tax implications in all of this that we see?
Yes, taxes are regulations. So the taxes applied to the energy industry will definitely be reviewed. There's also a separate executive order directed at tax reform. So there are a number of ways in which I think taxes will be revisited, and in particular for the energy industry.
But probably not a carbon tax, not in this administration.
Well, I doubt it, but you know, you never know. But yeah, and also along with taxes, Andy mentioned this earlier, subsidies will be revisited.
Yeah.
I think.
Oh,
yeah.
Good point.
Yeah.
Good point. Any other examples we should flag for our listeners on areas or actions within the scope of the executive order we ought to be focusing on?
It's so broad, it's hard to know where to start.
Right.
But just to give one example that it might not be obvious on the face of it, for example. There already started to be efforts within DOE to revisit the role of the Energy Information Administration. And it does studies and analysis. There are some people who feel that it's understated the availability of natural gas in the United States. And that might be another example of kind of a big picture issue that might not be obvious, but essentially the goal of the executive order is to step back and to thoroughly rethink what the federal government does and how it affects energy development and use. And so it's almost innumerable. We can go on for hours.
Well, and the flip side of it is EIA's analysis of perhaps undervaluing some of the true costs of renewables in the system as well. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Actually, Daniel Simmons, who heads the task force, his organization has done considerable work in that area. So it's clearly on the table.
Yeah. Last line I want to throw out to all of you, any specific issues you want to recommend given the timeline, the quick timeline we're under, or any other final thoughts you've got?
I think Andy already said it, which is the time is now to evaluate things. And
correct.
I think everybody has to, particularly for all of us who've been working in our careers with heavily regulated industries, you really have to start thinking outside the box. It's almost unbelievable about how much this represents an opportunity to revisit some things that I think have been taken for granted for a very long time.
Great.
I think it's also, I would just suggest that folks understand that issue spotting doesn't count in this process. You have to, and I've worked with some companies and associations on comments. You have to drill down to the reg. You have to identify the issue, put the fix or proposed fix out there so the people at EPA, these won't all go through the program offices. It has to be done clearly and in simple English if you want your comments to really resonate. So it requires a little homework, done quickly, but definitely requires some homework.
I'd say for many of the listeners at least, it's really important to establish an internal team, figure out how you're going to track all of this. And as Sheila said, think out of the box. There usually has been, in almost every area, there are issues that have been debated for years. They're all up for review, essentially. But in addition, the intent of this is to go step further back and really, in the end, craft a new national energy policy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, in sum, it is a incredibly consequential executive order. Lots of tentacles, lots of areas people are going to have to think about from both an offensive and defensive category. On behalf of Pillsbury's Energy, Environment, and Public Policy sections, thank you all for joining us. We'll be following this one very closely. We'll be happy to help you out as it goes forward. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.